Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. I'm glad you could join us for this very important podcast. I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Brent Willock. He is a very distinguished psychologist and psychoanalyst. In addition to being the chief psychologist at the Hincks Treatment Center in Toronto, he has been an adjunct faculty member at York University and an associate faculty member in the School of Graduate Studies at the University of Toronto. He is the president of the Toronto Institute for Contemporary Psychoanalysis and serves on the board of the Canadian Institute for Child and Adolescent Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy. He's a faculty member in the postgraduate program in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy at Adelphi University's Durner School of Psychology. He is also a writing mentor for my very own institute, the Washington Baltimore Center for Psychoanalysis in New Directions. And this is a program in psychoanalytic thinking. He's also an associate editor for Analytic Dialogues. He has contributed many book chapters and articles. He has also written two books, Comparative Integrative Psychoanalysis and the one we're going to discuss today, The Wrongful Conviction of Oscar Pistorius. And that particular book has been endorsed by three of the world's leading experts in sleep disorders for scientific accuracy. It can be found in the front of the book. Okay, so Brent, if I may call you Brent. So now I have established that you are a very distinguished psychoanalyst and author. I'd like to find out how you originally became interested in the case of Oscar Pistorius and a little bit about the case, since I think it's possible that some people may not remember the details and other people may not know that this was a very high profile case with an international trial that emerged as a result of something that occurred on February 14th in 2013.
Yes, sure. I'd be glad to do that, Karen. Well, how I became interested in, well, maybe I should say a little word about who Oscar Pistorius is leading up to it, since there might be someone who doesn't know. He was born in 1986 in Pretoria, South Africa. And the birth was kind of awful in the sense that he had below the knees, his legs were missing bones, toes, kind of the image in my mind as if he had gone through a meat grinder. And his parents consulted a dozen physicians. Some said, well, we can do a series of operations over many, many years, or we can amputate his legs now. And his parents went for, let's amputate them now. So in his 11th month on the planet, that's what happened. And pretty traumatic start to his life. And then he was fitted with prostheses and oddly enough, he became a very active kid. He had an older brother, and he followed him around everywhere, riding bikes, climbing trees, falling out of trees, and kind of a rough and tumble boyish life. And then as he got older, he became very interested in sports. Again, I'm amazed at this. One would think a more bookish profession would appeal, but he became involved in sports until the point where he had a very serious rugby injury and was in rehab at the hospital. And a doctor suggested, maybe you better take up another kind of sport than heavy contact like you're into with rugby. You should think about running. And Oscar did that, and he, I guess you could say, never looked back. He had a talent for it. I guess he was athletically talented anyhow, but especially for running. And so he began going in Paralympic kind of games and doing very, very well. And he aspired to go to the regular Olympics. And there's quite a story leading up to that, but bottom line would be that in 2012 in London, he participated in the regular Olympics, and he was the story of the Olympics. He and Usain Bolt, for being a super fast Jamaican runner with a kind of a dramatic flair, and Oscar for, holy cow, how could anyone who's been amputated before the age of one be in the Olympics? So these were the stories of the Olympics, and that was in 2012. Not too many months after that, fast forward to Valentine's Day 2013, and Oscar, he's been dating Reva Steenkamp. I guess she's described as being a very attractive model and a law student, and so very impressive in her own right, as was Oscar. Oscar was known to those around the world as, well, just amazing. He was on the equivalent of Dancing with the Stars on Italian television, and playing in celebrity golf tournaments for charities. And so Valentine's Day comes up, and they decide they will stay at Oscar's home, and Reva will cook up some dinner, and they will enjoy that, and they did. Then Oscar goes to bed, because that's what athletes do, and Reva stays up to do a bit of yoga, because that's what young women do, I guess, or sometimes men. So she comes to bed, and in the middle of the night, or really the early part of the night, Oscar wakes up to take in a very tall fan that they had in the doorway, two fans actually, but the prominent tall fan. And he gets up to take that in, I guess, and he closes all the doors and blinds and drapes. And then he's about to put Reva's jeans that are on the floor on top of a little LED device that's making some light in the room. He wants it as black as possible. While he's doing that, he hears a sound in the bathroom, and he immediately thinks there's an intruder. That would be a natural thought, in the sense that his parents divorced when he was six, and his mom moved the kids to a edgier part of town where there were more break-ins, very high crime rate everywhere in South Africa. And so his mother would sleep with a gun under her pillow, and whenever she heard the slightest sound, she would leap out of bed, call 911, hustle the kids into her bedroom, and wait there with her gun cocked until the police arrived. And they would always, or almost always, tell her there was no concern, there's no one around. So Oscar was used to this very panicky, hyper-aroused, middle-of-the-night scenario. And that sort of seemed what he went into when he heard this sound. And he tells Reva to get down on the floor or under the bed, call the police. And he tells her he's going down the hall to investigate with his gun. And he goes down screaming at the top of his lungs, for the burglars or killers to get out of their home. And there's no sound, and he approaches. They have like a bathroom stall inside the larger bathroom, which has the shower and tub and sink, and there's a stall in there. And he hears a sound on the other side of the stall door that meant to him that they're about to come out, they're moving. And so he fires his gun through the door 4 times, and then he goes back to the bed to make sure Reva's calm and there's no Reva there, whereupon he goes, oh my God, maybe that was her in the bathroom. He goes back, he bashes down the door, and it's a bloody mess, kind of like his birth. And he calls the security of the housing complex, and he calls the hospital, and he calls his neighbor, a physician, and the neighbor arrives, and the hospital told them, drive her yourself to the hospital, because by the time the ambulance gets there, it'll be too late. And so he's got Reva's barely breathing body at the door, and the physician friend comes in, and Reva dies in his arms. Police arrive. The police detective said, at least to himself, I've seen this 1,000 times. Men get into jealous rages. They kill their partner. And this is obviously what has happened. And Oscar explained his side of the story, that he thought it was burglars coming to harm them. But so they took him to jail. And the next day he gives his bail application and the bail magistrate accepted that, although he made some interesting comments that we'll get to later, no doubt. And then Oscar eventually goes to court. A little different than the American system. There's no jury. There's a judge and her helper. And she believed Oscar's story, as opposed to the prosecution's, that it was a jealous rage. She believed his story. She mentions 4 things that made no sense to her, but she said she was, despite the fact that the court has to make sense of all evidence, she was going to proceed and sentence him for what we'd call manslaughter. They call culpable homicide. And so he was sentenced for maybe around 7 years, approximately. And then, I don't know, there were some appeals. I don't know if you want to go into that, but things got worse for him by the appeals. The Supreme Court of Appeal agreed with the prosecution that they said, yes, this is murder, because he may not have been trying to murder Reva, but that doesn't matter. If you fire 4 bullets into a cubicle, you're probably going to kill somebody. So we'll call it murder, and we'll increase his sentence to the minimum, which is 15 years. And and then Oscar's to prison. No, let's see. So, how did I get involved in it? You said, yes. Yes, thank you, Karen. Yes. So I was writing something else about another kind of violent case, but and there was something that reminded me of the Oscar case, and I wanted to go and retrieve a little detail that might be relevant to this thing I was writing. And I must say that there must be, if not a God, the equivalent of a God that guides one some places, because I can't quite fathom it. Up came this thing, Judge Masipa's judgment, and it was very, very detailed, weighing all the evidence and the expert testimony. And then she's getting towards the end, and she says, there's 4 things about your narrative, Mr. Pistorius, that make absolutely no sense to me. And she listed them. And when I say divine or something, they immediately made sense to me. And as a sleep and dreaming disorder, which I'm sure we'll get into later. But so I started to think about it and read everything I could about it. And wondered how could I be of help? Because I became quite convinced that there was a very important alternative explanation to this. And so I researched a lot, and I thought, oh, well, I'll write an article. If I can do that, that'll give some credibility to my views or something. And then it turned out, I felt I had to say much more about sleep disorders and things. And so it became a book. And but that's, yeah, that's, I'm still amazed that one, that the judgment came up, and two, that the things that puzzled the judge, to me as a certain type of psychologist, made eminent sense, even though, and they had baffled the bail magistrate virtually the same points long before the trial. They had and he took care to put them into his thing. These things make no sense, but for sure I'll grant you bail because you're not a danger to anyone. But I can get into that, or maybe there's other things you want to ask me, Karen.
Oh, yes. This could be a course instead of a podcast, or could at least be two, but we'll start with one. Do you recall the four things the judge wrote that piqued your interest?
I sure do, Karen. Yes. So she said, Mr. Pistorius, if you heard a sound and thought it might be a burglar, surely anyone would turn to their partner and say, honey, did you hear that sound? And she's right. In fact, a former girlfriend at trial said, yeah, that happened quite a few times. We would hear a sound, or he would hear a sound, and he would always ask me, did you hear that sound? And typically she would say, I did, or it was just the wind, and nothing came of it. So the judge says, surely you would have told her. And yes, of course he would have. Well, she would have responded something. And when she didn't respond anything, because she was in the bathroom, Oscar would instantly know she wasn't there, or he would wake her up, or he would make sure she heard. It's very important. So I'm thinking in terms of sleep disorders, and I think, yes, he would have. He would have done what any person would have done if he had been fully awake. And sleep disorders, or parasomnias, as they're sometimes called, they're situations where your brain is partly awake and partly asleep simultaneously. And so if he had been fully awake, it occurred to me that, yes, he would have realized she hadn't responded to him. He would have then realized she's not in the bed. He would have then reasoned very easily she was in the bathroom. He would have called out to her. End of story. So that was the judge's first point. The second point was said, Oscar, you told Reva to get down on the floor and call the police. Surely she would have said, yep, I've got that, dear. I'll do that. Or don't go down the hall, the short hallway to the bathroom. Don't go near the bathroom. You'll get hurt. Let's go out the balcony or what. She would have responded to his instructions to call the police. And when she didn't, of course, judge is right. He would have said, Reva, do you hear me? This is serious. Call the police. I say in my mind to the judge, he would have done that if he had been 100% awake instead of X percent awake. And then the judge says, Mr. Pistorius, you're going down the hall yelling at the top of your lungs for them to get out of your home. Surely Reva in the stall would have said, honey, it's me. Calm down. Don't shoot. Go back to bed. I'll be with you in a minute. And of course she would have, and maybe she did. But in parasomnia, you may not hear too well. It wasn't that there's different kinds of parasomnias. He wasn't in a deep sleepwalking state or anything, but he was, nonetheless, he didn't have all neurons operative, in my opinion. And so he probably didn't hear her yelling. I'm sure she was yelling at him to not shoot and calm down. But he probably wasn't hearing that. But the judge, I agree, was absolutely right. Any person in a normal state of consciousness would have heard Riva, and maybe he wasn't even calling out loud. So, but there's another case I can talk about later. But sometimes people, when they're not firing on all cylinders, they can think they're yelling at the top of their lungs, but nothing comes out. You know, so it's in these paradoxical sleep disordered states. But either way, Judge is right. If he had been able to yell, and if he had been able to hear, all that, no shots would have been fired. Then he goes back to the bed after he fires the four shots to check on Riva. And the judge says, or she says, why did you fire four shots, Mr. Pistorius? Or she doesn't really ask him. She says, it makes no sense that you fired four shots. I'm not sure why that doesn't make sense. Maybe, of course, it would be civilized to fire a warning shot or something, I suppose. But I don't know, in a situation of panic, let alone sleep disorder, but just panic, whether one thinks of such proper niceties. But to my mind, thinking of sleep disorder, people will sleep through, like there's husbands who've shot their wives or even shot themselves, and they sleep right through it. And they wake up and they find their own leg bleeding or their wife injured or dead, but they sleep right through bullets. And so I'm thinking, yeah, Oscar, probably just like you sleep through an alarm clock, the first couple of rings maybe, but then it does wake you up. Well, maybe the fourth shot finally woke him up 100%. He was already X percent awake, but now he's 100% awake. He instantly sees that Riva's not in the bed. He instantly reasons that she must have been or could have been the one in the bathroom. He's working 100% mental capacity at this point, but he was totally impaired up to that point. That's in all my research, the books that have been written about it and articles, the only other puzzle that came out, Karen, was that the police had photographs of the scene that showed that he had not moved the big fan in out of the balcony doorway. He had not closed the doors. He had not closed the blinds. And the prosecutor, who was known as the Bulldog, said, this proves you're a lying murderer, Mr. Pistorius. You couldn't have run out on that balcony if that fan was still blocking the way, could you? And Oscar said, no, I couldn't have. If that photograph were true, then my story would have been proved false, because I couldn't have run out like I said I did and called to the neighbors and everyone for help. But later I'll have witnesses that will show that the police rejigged this crime scene. And I thought to myself, there's no reason the police would rejig any crime scene, because he had confessed instantly to everybody that he had killed Riva. And so there's no reason they would do that. On the other hand, there's no reason Oscar would tell lies about bringing in fans, closing windows. That would be trivia irrelevant. So it didn't make sense that he either would be telling a falsehood. Whereupon Sigmund Freud came to my assistance. In his monumental classic, The Interpretation of Dreams, he wrote about something called dreams of inconvenience. And that's like, well, the most common example is if we need to urinate, instead of waking up and getting up, we dream. We're at the toilet taking care of that and relieving ourselves, and we continue sleeping. And Freud had said a key function of dreams is to preserve sleep, because we need sleep so badly. And so it seemed to me that was the only other puzzling element in the trial to me. No experts ever came to say the police rejigged the situation. That was Lord knows where Oscar dug that up. But so that he had, in my opinion, had been having a dream of convenience. He never got up to bring in the fan or close the drapes or anything. He dreamt he was doing all that. Very convenient. So he continued to get the restorative sleep he needed to go rigorously train for his professional athletic career. So but while he was having the dream of convenience, he heard a sound. Probably there really was a sound of Reva either getting out of bed or closing the window in the bathroom, or and that triggered him to come into a partially awake state, not completely. Sadly, if he had completely awake, he never would have gone anywhere near the bathroom with any gun or anything. So that was how I got involved in the case, and I really don't quite know how I saw these things so clearly. They jumped out at me. I wish I could go back in time, because it probably made sense, but now it just seems like it's divine intervention or something. It just, or Jung's synchronicity or something that was meant to be or something. But I'm kind of glad it happened, for sure. And it's been very interesting ever since that moment.
Yeah, I'm just guessing about this next thing I'm going to say, but I would imagine that people, this is more prevalent than people really talk about. I was recalling as I read your book that my father used to do something. He didn't get up, but it was clearly he was struggling, and he would talk in his sleep about war. And it seemed like he was fighting in his sleep about the war. And when he was asked in the morning, he had no recollection of that at all. I just assumed it was a nightmare, but it was a clear physical struggle he was having.
Yeah.
So I guess that maybe that's one form. I don't know, but it just...
I think so, because, you know, in sleep... Freud said the access to motility is closed off. He was talking about dreams in particular during REM sleep, but it's generally true when we're certainly during dreams, unless we have a sleep disorder, and generally, I think your dad must have been dreaming, and so Freud says the access to motility is closed off neurophysiologically. Except when it isn't, and as in your dad's case, so he's moving his arms, he's speaking words, he's obviously having visualizations of war, and it is much more common than we think. Whenever I talk about this, people come up with the most interesting of examples that they've done or intimate people in their lives have done, much more common. Well, in surveys, 2% of people say they've done violent things in their sleep. So that's pretty high, 2%. And others may not remember that they've done them.
And others may not talk about it.
Precisely.
Survey that way. There's one particular case that you talk about in your book. Can you just briefly say something about it? Because I think it illustrates this very clearly. And that's the case of Ken and Karen Parks, specifically Ken and what happened to him.
Yeah. That's up in my neck of the woods, just outside of Toronto, that happened. And Kenneth, a young man, no criminal history, no violent history. He went to the racetrack one night and did well on his first visit. And he believed he might have a special knack for picking the winners. And he thought, that'd be great. I can earn some money, and I can send my wife to her native Australia to visit her family. And that'll be nice. I was going to say, I'll be a hero. I don't know if that's what he thought, but that's my projection. So, but he kept on losing and losing, as one tends to do in these gambling endeavors. And so he began taking money from their joint bank account. He began defrauding his company, taking money. They finally caught on and confronted him and fired him. So he mortgaged the house to pay them back so they wouldn't take him to court. But created great stress in their marriage and in their life. He's unemployed. Their house is up for remortgage, and so his wife said, "Look, you've got to tell our parents and your grandma what's going on here." So he said, "Yeah, okay, I will on Saturday." And Saturday came, and his wife's off working as a nurse, Karen. And he doesn't. He goes play rugby instead. Seems rugby comes into the story again. And she's furious. And he says, look, I'll tell them tomorrow when we go to your parents for the barbecue. I'll tell them all that I've screwed up on." And so that night before going to the barbecue, and he's been insomniac for 2 weeks, maybe longer. And insomnia is it really facilitates parasomnia, so it does things to the brain chemistry, and but he does fall asleep this night, but unbeknownst to him, he wakes up, and he drives to his in-laws in the middle of the night, and about the same time of night when these things are quite likely to happen, but he drives to his in-laws. He's asleep, really. He doesn't know it, but he drives to his in-laws for 14 miles. Amazing. And he gets there. He takes a tire iron from the trunk of his car. He remembered to bring the key to their home. He opens it. He goes in. He almost kills his stepfather, his father-in-law. And there was mutual love between these three people. He liked them. He got along better than he did with his own parents with them. The mother called him her gentle giant. He's a big guy. And he succeeds in killing her. And he runs up the stairs to tell the adult children in the bedroom, kids, nothing to worry about. You're in no danger. They later heard no words coming out of his mouth. They heard rawr, 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 sounds like you might make if you were asleep. So that goes back to what I was saying about Oscar speaking to Reva and not hearing Reva and all that. So he drives himself to the police station. His hands are all really badly bloodied, nerves and tendons cut, and tells the police, "I think I've killed two people." And they take him to the trauma center at the hospital to be stitched up. And then he wonders if he killed his wife, because he doesn't know. He says, "I don't know what happened. I fell asleep. And then the next thing I know, I wake up over the body of my mother-in-law with her having this helpless help me look on her face. And I don't remember what happened from falling asleep to then." He made up a weird, he said, "The only thing I think has happened is some people drugged my Kool-Aid that I was drinking that night and dragged me into their van and drove me to the scene of the crime. And I woke up when I was there and tried to take the knife away from them and got my hand cut and woke up as they were killing my in-laws." And he said, "I know that story doesn't make any sense, but it makes more sense than driving 14 miles along the highway in the middle of the night in my sleep. It's a better story than that." But the lawyer he had, she was married to a psychologist, a forensic psychologist, I guess. And she worked across the street from me. He worked in my building. And the two of them, I guess, and other experts began to think, could this be a parasomnia? Could he have done all this in his sleep? And so they got a lot of prominent experts to come into the case. And they were very skeptical at first that this could happen in one's sleep. But they became convinced the more they got into it, that it was parasomnia. And interestingly, I mean, one of the things experts look for is, does the person have a individual or family history of parasomnia? And there was only one incident of Kenneth in his, when he was 11 years old, he was in the middle of the night. He was about to go out a seventh floor balcony window, and he would have fallen probably to his death if a family member hadn't happened by, more divine intervention, and grabbed his leg and saved him. But that was the only incident in Kenneth's personal history, and it came from many years back. I later found out from, well, I can go into that later maybe, about Oscar having similarly just one, but an important incident in his early life. So Kenneth, the experts come. They're so convincing in their presentation that the defense experts, no, the prosecution experts say, look, we don't have anything to say. It's clearly parasomnia. And they, so he was acquitted. He was told to go into psychotherapy. I don't even know quite the reasoning on that. Maybe just the feeling that if you've murdered your wife's mother and almost her father, you're going to have some issues that are going to need help. So he did that. Plus there's some medication you can take to regulate your sleep waves. So you don't have, in his case, simultaneous sleep and wake waves going at the same time. You tone that down. I don't know if he would have had that if he hadn't had chronic insomnia and ginormous stress of having to go humiliate himself in front of his in-laws by confessing that he had totally messed up badly and wasn't quite the individual he wanted them to think he was. So profound shame. I don't think if he didn't have this kind of stuff propelling him that he would have had parasomnia probably. But anyhow, the last I heard of him, he was doing well. He was remarried. His wife had stuck by him throughout everything, but eventually, I guess she couldn't, and one can understand that. But he remarried, had more kids, and was running for trustee of the school board, the last I heard of him, whereupon people in the community said, what? No. So I imagine he didn't get that position, but at least he was wanting to be civically involved and contributing. And yeah, so that case was, yeah, compelling to me, educational to me in terms of the strange things that can go on in one's sleep. And Oscar's is a different parasomnia, but there's so many different ones. People get up and have sleep sex, and they're snoring while they're having intercourse. Or they get up and cook meals in the night, and they develop an obesity problem that they don't know hardly where it's coming from. Sometimes the meals, they don't eat them. That's okay for obesity. But sometimes they cook them up with, oh, we'll put some of this cleaning powder that's under the sink in, and toxic substances. And so it's just quite remarkable, the combination of good judgment, bad judgment, or fully alertness and fully asleepness, kind of. Yeah.
Well, I have another question about Oscar, but it is quite interesting. I would imagine that this occurs more than we know, in a higher percentage of people than we know about. I looked through the psychoanalytic literature, and I didn't really find very much at all. There's your article. Not too much else.
No. Yes, it's the only article that has the word parasomnia in the title is mine. And the only other article in the PEP web literature, which is pretty enormous, is a footnote in one article that mentions that word parasomnia. But it's pretty absent. In that article that I wrote for Psychoanalytic Psychology, there's a second case I discuss, and it's very hair-raising. And it's about what I would call nightmare enactment, where I believe a 20-year-old university student, I won't go into details, but horrifically killed 3 out of 4 members of his family and in the middle of the night. And he reported that he had observed this happening from the bathroom, had tried to intervene, eventually chased the killers off, But there was no evidence of any killers, any breaking into the home, totally securely gated community with barbed wire and electronic devices and security guards and patrols. 20-year-old university student under some stress, for sure, definitely, and some reason to be angry at his family, for sure. But so that's interesting in terms of the intersection of dream theory and sleep disorder theory. The Oscar is not so much about dream theory, except for that he was probably in a dream of convenience when he woke up. So he was in an altered state of consciousness already. But from there on, he wasn't enacting a dream, I don't think. Whereas this other young South African did seem to be enacting a nightmare. And so I think it's quite interesting that psychoanalysis has a lot to share with sleep researchers and vice versa. Yeah, there's...
Absolutely. What I was thinking about as you were talking about Oscar's situation with his mother early on. I mean, we know as child and adolescent psychoanalysis and adult psychoanalysis as well, that childhood experiences are so important, so that they moved to a neighborhood that was not particularly safe and that there were break-ins. And I imagine he was scared as a youngster. It plays such a role. So it seems like there are precursors to these things.
Yes. Yeah, very clearly in Oscar's case. Yeah. Precursors. Yeah. And what I was thinking of earlier, the incident when he was in his late teens, he and his cousins always used to go to their grandparents by the seaside, where they had a condominium. Usually the youngsters would go out at night to party, and they knew they had to be in by midnight. But if they didn't, they would climb up the four flights on the balconies, and they knew they could get into their grandparents by the balcony door. And so the situation is a little bit reminiscent of Oscar's balcony door being open the night the intruders supposedly came in. But Oscar, one night, he didn't go out with them because he was seriously training for athletics. And so he was sleeping on the couch because he had short legs when he takes his prosthesis off, and he was the only one who could get a good night's sleep on the couch. So after midnight comes and he hears a sound, which is his cousins coming in the balcony door, and he immediately thinks it's dangerous intruders, and he hobbles again, as he did with Riva Steenkamp. He hobbles this time to his grandparents' bed and jumps into their bed between them and says, there's an intruder. And they're quite startled that this very strong athletic guy is jumping in like a frightened child between them. And obviously his reasoning hasn't woken up, not his good full reasoning. Otherwise he would have just said, oh, those assholes coming back after partying, they're probably drunk, and checked it out and told them to shut the F up and all that. His brain was not fully awake. So that's like Kenneth Parks. I had just one previous incident, but I guess we can say those can be very significant and not to be taken too lightly. Maybe especially Oscar's having when he's, I think, 19 years old. So young adult kind of. So precursors of various sorts. And I guess who knows how to take these things, but maybe at least in the context of this conversation, maybe we should take them a little more seriously than we do.
So moving forward, I read on March 31st in several papers. What was the LA Times? This was, I think this was in major newspapers probably around the world.
Yes, it was, yeah.
I think it happened on March 30th, but I read it on the 31st that Oscar was denied parole and will have to serve it at least a year, 0.3, a year and 3 months more. I don't know if it's a foregone conclusion that it'll be paroled after that. I imagine it isn't.
Right.
There's something I'd like to quote from the LA Times. The parole board cited a new clarification on Pistorius's sentence that was issued by South Africa's Supreme Court of Appeal just 3 days before the hearing. A little bit later on, still quoting, still legal experts criticized authorities' decisions to go ahead with the hearing when Pistorius was not eligible. So it seems to me that the Supreme Court decided he wasn't eligible for parole, but they had the hearing anyway. Do you have thoughts about how this news may have affected Oscar? I mean, one could speculate. Certainly wasn't good news, but I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, it's an important point, Karen. Even weirder is the fact that this happened about a year earlier. Oscar came to the parole board and fully thinking he'd get out, because as far as I can tell, he's been supermodel prisoner. He's from a very religious family, and Oscar in prison was holding Bible study groups and prayer groups, and some very rough characters, gang members in the prison, were coming to his groups because he's a national hero, really, before he fell off his pedestal. But so they come to his groups, and the warden, I'm told, just loves Oscar because the whole temperature of the prison has come down because of people having this hero amongst themselves who's telling them about God and Jesus and whatever else. And so I think he had a vegetable garden growing in the courtyard, and all kinds of things that are very constructive. And so I'm sure he would have got the green light out of prison. But at that parole hearing a year before this march, they quarreled, they argued, oh no, we made a mistake. You haven't really served half your time, and that's what you got to serve to appeal. So they must have known before the actual the actual parole hearing, they must have known at least the day before, probably long before. But so his hopes go to this hearing, and then they're dashed with a weirdness of reasoning. But okay, mistakes do happen. But then a year or so later, he goes again to the parole on the supposed time when he's now for sure done half his sentence. And the dispute had to do with how much time he had served on the previous conviction for manslaughter, culpable homicide, all that. But there's no secrets to it. It's all written in ink, kind of. But so, yes, this March, he goes to the parole board. And again, they tell him, no, you haven't really served half your sentence. You've got to wait until a year plus 4 months. Now, that begins to defy comprehension. And so you say, the LA Times says many legal authorities are critical, maybe baffled, I don't know. I'm both baffled and since baffled, therefore critical. But maybe there's some reason, but it sure hasn't been put out there to the public as how they could possibly have made a blunder a second time. There's quite a few things about this case that the more I get into it that make no sense. But this is one that just seems... So how has it affected Oscar? Well, he would have been devastated. I know his legal team planned to appeal it, but I haven't heard of any appeal happening. Whether an appeal can happen sometimes those things are slow and maybe they're just waiting till next August. But it's kind of beyond baffling. And there are Yeah. Well, I don't want to, you have questions. I could go on about other things that are baffling about this trial, and I will if you ask me to, but you might have other questions you want to ask.
Well, I have some, but I'm also interested in what you have to say. I'll just ask a couple. I wondered if you ever had any contact with him, whether you tried to contact him or maybe
You
it
know,
wasn't feasible. I don't know.
it was not easy, but finally I did. His father got a copy of his book to me, and I had tried to get letters to Oscar. Maybe one of them finally came through. He did write me a long letter, yeah, and he it, w what he said, your book provides a compelling explanation of what might have happened that night. It's not an excuse. I'm not looking for an excuse, but it did provide an explanation. You know, the night before his sentencing, he was on British television, and he said things like, "What could have possibly happened? To this day, I don't know what could have possibly happened." And I thought that was interesting because his story made sort of made coherent sense, except for the huge holes in it. His story that he thought it was intruders, but anyhow, he said, "What could possibly have happened?" And so I guess when he says my book provided him an explanation, a plausible explanation of what might have happened, and he encouraged me to speak with a psychologist who was involved with his case, which I did, and that was interesting. And so that's really my only contact. He said to me, "I can't send or receive messages really here because everything is scrutinized, surveilled by the prison authorities, my phone calls, my mail." I said, but he gave me the name of a friend of his with whom I could send a message and talk if that was needed. And I did talk with her, and I've had some contact with his father, and it was an aunt of his who sent me that very important piece of information from when Oscar was 19 and couldn't figure out that his cousins were coming back from partying. But I've had kind of very little direct contact with him and his family. Would have liked for more, but it's been, I would say, surprisingly little.
I wonder if you're still writing about these issues beyond Oscar's case.
Yeah, Karen, it seems I am. I've invested, I don't know, maybe emotionally, I've cathected, I've invested so much into this, I guess, that I want to try to see it through to, I don't want it just to be a book that gets up in the remainder bin or something. I wanted it to have an impact. And so I did write that article for Psychoanalytic Psychology, one of the journals of the American Psychological Association. And all then I got the idea, I'm not having any luck with getting any conversation about this going in South Africa. His family is hardly speaking to me, except for maybe his father and that. And the media, whenever I reach out to them, like if I see something that they've written or interviewed about this on radio or television, I write to them and say, "Look, maybe you'd be interested in another perspective on this case." And they never are. They either don't respond or they say thank you, and they never are interested, which totally intrigues me. They seem locked in the two possible stories: either that it was a regrettable accident, or he's a liar and he killed her in a fit of jealous rage. They seem locked in that battle, but not very open to another hypothesis. So I said, "Well, I'll try and write something for a law journal in South Africa and see if I can get some, maybe the lawyers would be interested, or at any rate, it would give more credibility to and ammunition to Oscar if he ever decided to appeal." And so I wrote something for a law journal, and they asked for revisions, and that's where that's at. It's under process of review. I'm very strongly hoping they will publish it. I think it's a good article. It's got a lot of interesting stuff in it. But yeah, so I don't know that I'd be writing anything else, although I didn't expect to be writing any of these things. So I don't have any plans to write anything, but I sure hope this law journal thing gets in there. And yeah, I don't know why the media, why no one in the media has any interest. So there's a lot of things that puzzle me about the case. Maybe someday I will see through a glass, not darkly.
It seems like I'd like to read a paragraph from the end of the book, because it seems like you're hopeful. This is the paragraph. The scientific dreaming and parasomnia perspective should enable Reva's parents and Oscar to one day soon have a very different conversation rather than angry confrontation. Their newly scientifically informed dialogue could instead become a healing communion. Rest in peace, sweet Reva. Now, somewhat older and wiser Oscar, may you also come to increasingly rest in peace. May the ideas in this book help all who care about these two individuals and the families and friends to move easily beyond this, realizing the events of St. Valentine's Day 2013 was almost certainly a horrific tragedy, not a heinous crime. So I'm taking from that, you must think at some point science will catch up with or move beyond these ideas people have, these fixed ideas that they can't take in this new information.
Yes, yes. Yes, I do have that very strong hope. I know in wrongful convictions, it's I've heard people who are trying to reverse wrongful convictions saying what a long and difficult battle it is. So apparently that's the case, as if not just the legal system, but maybe those of us who sort of believe somewhat in the legal system don't want to hear that it gets things wrong. I'm not sure what the cognitive dissonance is there, but apparently it's true kind of across the board. But wrongful convictions are getting overturned with greatly increasing frequency in the United States. It's about three a week now. And maybe would be more if there were more resources available. But what resources are had? It's three a week, and these people have, on average, been in prison for 14 years, and so there's more openness, at least in the United States. But I think so. That's even creeping into my country, Canada. They're starting to look a little more at that, and in England, and. And hopefully South Africa. Yeah, so I really do hope that science will prevail. It's often science of one form or the other. Of course, we know of DNA evidence exonerating some people, but often in cases of so-called arson murder, it's being proved that there wasn't arson at all. They have more scientific standards for ascertaining now whether a fire was deliberately set or accidentally set. And a lot of cases for that had been convicted for arson murder, people are being let out. So, I'm hoping it's not quick. Yes, I say in that paragraph that the Mr. and Mrs. Steenkamp may find some relief from this perspective. I think they would, to know that at least she hadn't been, well, deliberately killed. Deliberately would have been sort of in a momentary insanity anyhow, but they want him to confess that he did this deliberately. And so in the South African system, before you can get bail, you have to have an attempted reconciliation with the victims or the parents in this case. And Oscar was flown across the country to where Riva's parents lived to have this dialogue. But I guess the parents must have changed their mind. And so months and months and months went by with this meeting not happening. Finally, the father only met with Oscar. His wife refused. And apparently it was an important meeting. Maybe both were in tears. And it was very emotional anyhow. But then afterward, I guess Mr. Pistorius aligned with his wife, and yes, we will not accept any parole until he admits he did it. And that's adamantly her position. So she's probably not in any mood to read a book such as mine. I wish she would, because it's not meant to be polemical. It's meant to be applying science of dream theory and sleep disorders. I said soon in that paragraph. I can see that word has not proven to be accurate. But no one would have predicted that, having said they would meet with him to have a potentially reconciliatory dialogue, no one would have presumed that would never happen, at least as far as Mrs. Pistorius is concerned. But maybe the impact of trauma, obviously, of course, they're all traumatized, and she perhaps above all else, but Mrs. Pistorius, and maybe the whole country is in a state of trauma. For Pistorius was almost next to Mandela and Nelson Mandela in terms of being a national hero in their pantheon of people doing the impossible. And I think socioculturally, when that happens, it's kind of a national trauma, and maybe there's a tendency to want to, or an inability to think, maybe, but or a wish not to think about it, just to close the chapter and move on, case closed. And courts found him guilty, great, should have given him more years, no doubt, but we'll let it be.
Well, I think that this is, it reminds me of the work that we do. Sometimes people get very fixated in one way of thinking and can't look at another perspective. It's just, this is the way it is, and that's that. And of course, those people are much harder to work with because no other possibilities seem like it enters the system.
Yes. Yes, totally correct. Yeah. Yes, we're very used to that in our clinical work. Unfortunately, that's a verity. But I was, I guess, surprised to learn how true it is everywhere, apparently, everywhere where there's trauma and feelings. And so I guess that's been important learning for me.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States now, there's such a divide, and people on one side are as convinced as they can be that X is the situation. It's not, it could be, it might be, let's discuss it. It is.
Yeah.
Books being banned from elementary schools. I mean, really? or high schools just banning books. I mean, when did we start banning books?
I know. We thought that was maybe hundreds of years ago. Yeah, I know. Yeah, we're learning a lot about ourselves or them and us, but we are. Yeah. It's a rude awakening, I guess. Yeah. I guess someone could say we've been sleepwalking or something. And now we're rudely awakened.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else? Obviously, we could talk for a long, long time. The book is wonderful. I hope people buy it. And there's actually a special opportunity, as I recall, that this is a special Kindle book, or there's a special Kindle feature in June, and people can buy it for, I believe it's 99¢. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. For the month of June, it's called a Kindle special feature. So, yeah, it's very affordable. I hope some people listening are interested, because it tells what we're talking about in lot of detail and about other cases too. Yeah,
absolutely. It's a wonderful book. I wonder if there's anything else you would like listeners to know about. There's so much, but anything in particular that you think is important that we haven't covered?
Oh, thanks. I'd love to go on at great length, but is there anything I feel really needs to be told at this point? No. I guess in my more proselytizing mode, I'd say I do hope some people will read it and maybe tell their friends. I just feel the more people who know about this issue in general of parasomnia, not just its criminal applications, but the more people know about this, it could be doing someone a great favor to gift them a 99-cent Kindle book. So that would be my hope, that the word gets around. I think it's important and can be enlightening, and happens far more in our personal lives or in the lives of our nations, that we need to be more awake to it. Otherwise, some things go quite wrong. Yeah,
I would imagine, which I alluded to earlier, that people have a grandmother or an aunt or somebody in their family, many people anyway, who've had some kind of sleep irregularity. Yeah. So it seems like it's an area where more study is certainly in order.
Yeah. And I think where our work as you and I, as psychotherapists or psychoanalysts, I think that comes into it. It's not something that sleep disorders people usually think about, but I think that Kenneth Parks, I don't know if he had been, if he could have been in therapy or analysis, that he wouldn't have had these stresses build up that propelled him into this thing. He wouldn't had this nocturnal volcano happening so it's an argument for what you and I do so much of, be it child or adult therapy. It's an argument for how helpful that can be in lowering the stress level, the conflict level, the defensive level, to being able to speak about things instead of enacting them. And so that I hope will come from it too.
Well, it was wonderful having you as a guest. Maybe there'll be an occasion for you to come back. Maybe there'll be new developments that we can talk about. That would be good. Or your law article. Let's see what emerges from that.
Okay.
That would be great.
Thank you, Karen. I would be delighted. I have been delighted to talk to you this hour and would be delighted at any future time.
Well, I'm also delighted. It's wonderful to meet you in person, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.